From Iowa Public Radio News, this is The Exchange. I'm Alex Hoyer, in for Ben Kiefer. The U.S. Department of Justice is increasing its efforts to stop the spread of child pornography and to prosecute the offenders. The number of people viewing, downloading, and creating explicit images of children is on the rise, and we'll be joined by U.S. Attorney Stephanie Rose to talk about the problem and possible solutions. And later in the hour, a discussion about foster care in Iowa. Over the last 4 years, the number of children placed in foster care has dropped by more than 20%. We'll talk with a mother who's turned her life around. She once had her children taken away, and now she counsels those who are in a similar situation. That's coming up on The Exchange, right after this news from NPR. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer, in for Ben Kiefer today. The U.S. Department of Justice is increasing its efforts to stop the exploitation of children. Last month, the department launched a national strategy to prevent the exploitation of children. Part of this strategy is to stop the spread of images involving sexually explicit acts with children and prosecuting those who view, download, or create child pornography. You can join the conversation at 1-866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100. You can send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk, and we're now on Facebook at Iowa Public Radio. Joining me now to talk about this national strategy and how the issue of child pornography is playing out in Iowa is the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa, Stephanie Rose. Stephanie Rose was nominated by President Obama in September of last year, and she was confirmed by the Senate in November. She joined us in our studios in Iowa City. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why is there such an increased effort to prosecute people involved with child pornography?
Well, I think we're seeing across the country two trends that have law enforcement very concerned. The first is that in what would be considered the traditional child pornography, that is young children being sexually exploited, we're seeing increasingly younger children and we're seeing increasing violence depicted in those images of those children. And so certainly anytime we have child victims growing in number, decreasing in age and growing in violence, we as a law enforcement community have to be very concerned. But the second trend that we're seeing that's just exploding in Iowa as well as other parts of the country is this issue of sexting, which is essentially kids sending sexually explicit images of themselves through cell phones and through other technology without really considering that that is probably child pornography, depending on the age of those children. And that's just exploding across our state right now. And so the national strategy is both to help those very young victimized children of traditional child pornography and to try and really stop and prevent this explosion of sexting.
You just mentioned sexting, sending texting images, possibly nude images of children. So what exactly is child pornography? I mean, we think of pictures, we think of videos. What is child pornography?
Child pornography really is any image of a child nude that where the focus of that image is, in fact, the nudity or the lewd display of their genitals or their breasts or other things. And what we're seeing is middle schoolers and high schoolers sending images of themselves to somebody who at this moment they are very much in love with. But what we're seeing is, in judgment being what it is at those ages, that those images then get forwarded on to sometimes large groups of people. And they continue to haunt these girls and these boys for many, many years. So a 17-year-old boy who receives a picture of his 17-year-old girlfriend, that's not yet child pornography. It's sexting. But when that 17-year-old boy turns 18 and he still has that same image of this underage girl, he now possesses child pornography, and that becomes a federal offense that has very severe penalties. And when that boy and that girl break up, as they inevitably do, and 10 years pass, that boy still has those images. And if he posts those on the internet or somewhere else, they're there forever. That girl can't do anything to get those images back. And when her own children look her up 20 years down the road, they're going to find that image, or her employer looks it up, or her parents look it up. It's just something that is so easily preventable, but not something that these kids that are doing this think about as far as long-term impact of what the decisions are they're making now.
Right. And you brought up this issue of sexting, of having the images when perhaps both parties are a minor. There was a specific case about a week and a half ago, a 25-year-old from Plymouth in North Iowa, Garrett Drew Ringer, pled guilty to a child pornography charge. This is like we're saying, just one example of the many child pornography prosecutions. Can you explain what happened with that case?
I can, and this is a great example of those issues we're talking about. This was a relationship that formed between the defendant here, Mr. Ringer, and his 17-year-old girlfriend. At the time, he was 19 and she was 17. The two of them took some sexually explicit images of themselves engaged in various sex acts.
They both agreed to it?
They both agreed to it. It was consensual. It was knowing. Then they break up, and about 6 years pass, and this man sends, Mr. Ringer sends messages through MySpace to the girl he used to date, saying essentially, if you don't agree to get back together for short term and have sex with me again, I'm going to post these photos of you. You wouldn't want that to happen. And several exchanges take place, and ultimately he was charged with and pled guilty to extortion for trying to use those images, as well as the possession of child pornography. And this is really exactly what we're talking about. At the time, it didn't seem like a big deal. We, as the federal prosecutors, although we could have gone after him for producing those images, wouldn't have prosecuted him when he was 19 and she was 17, probably. But 6 years later, when he's using those same images as now a 25-year-old man to threaten her and to extort her, certainly we're going to come knocking. And this man is now going to spend at least 5 years, if not more, in federal prison because of this behavior.
So there's more leniency if the children are closer in age, 17, 19.
I think generally speaking, we're not going to prosecute juveniles. The federal government isn't. Now the state could. But generally speaking, the things we're going to consider are how close in age are these two? Is it consensual? Is it knowing? How severe are the images? And then what happens to the images? But the farther apart those two people get in age, the older the male or female, whichever one is the older of the two gets, the more egregious the photographs are. Those are when we're going to start getting more involved. But even when they are what you would think of as fairly innocuous photos, they can have lasting and really tragic consequences for these people. And there's two very well-known stories out there nationally. And one is a 13-year-old eighth grader in Florida who took a picture of herself topless, sent it to her then boyfriend. He forwarded it to everybody. And eventually she commits suicide because of the fallout from that decision for her. And her name was Hope Witzel. And a very similar string of events for a girl named Jessie Logan, who was an 18-year-old in Ohio, who took pictures of herself nude, sent them to a boyfriend. He forwarded them to everybody. And she eventually committed suicide. And so these are, you know, at the time, these images may seem really, in today's society, fairly mundane, but they're not, and the lasting consequences aren't.
What about that kind of situation here in Iowa? Has there been such an extreme case as somebody committing suicide because they've been
harassed? Not that we know of, and certainly part of our goal as law enforcement agents is to prevent that, and that's part of why we're doing these kinds of interviews, is the goal being to prevent these things from happening before they ever reach that point, to stop a young girl or a young boy from making this kind of life-altering mistake. You know, the tattoo that you can get removed in 10 years when you decide you don't want a dragon tattooed forever on your back, you know, this is an image you can never remove, and it's going to be with you forever. So the only way to prevent that is not to ever have it created in the first place. And that's going to take, in today's environment of peer pressure, you know, groups of kids deciding this is a bad idea and we're not going to do it.
When does someone cross that line as to when it becomes child pornography? Does it have to be nude, or can it be young children in a bathing suit? How does that work?
Well, it could be if it were young children where the genitals are lasciviously displayed, even if they are clothed, it could be child pornography. Certainly the easiest line is going to be nudity. But you could conceive of a situation where you had a group of, you know, 8-year-olds in bathing suits who the focus of those photos were their genital area, and that could become child pornography. But typically it's going to be nude. It's mm-hmm. going to be nudity.
How bad of a problem is this? Because I'm sure, you know, large portion of people never even look at child pornography, never come across it.
It is horrifyingly common. I don't think anybody who doesn't have this as an interest could conceive of how much of it is out there and how easy it's become to access and to trade and to create. And because that marketplace exists, there are more and more children victimized every year because the market will demand that there be more victims created for people who are interested in watching that. And certainly we want to do everything we can to save those children, to prosecute the people who have abused them, and also to prevent some of these other kids that are out there that are a little older and are making it themselves from going down that road as well.
It's been said not just with child pornography, but with a lot of crimes that the law is usually a step or two behind what's actually going out there. So we're talking about cell phones, about sexting. What about other forms of technology and how it's perhaps proliferating child pornography?
Well, child pornography can be, you know, in the 30 years ago, you had to sort of order a magazine through the mail, and you received it in a brown paper sack, and you know, you really couldn't get very much of it. But now you can get it on your iPhone, you can get it on your computer, you can get it sent to your phones, you can send it through you know, digital cameras, digital video recorders. You can get a camera on your computer and live, you know, shot back and forth with people. So it's just the ability to transmit this stuff quickly and rapidly and far-reaching has exploded. And so, yeah, obviously law enforcement is behind trying to catch up with that trend.
And with law enforcement, earlier this summer it was reported that in Cedar Rapids, child pornography offenders avoid arrest for several months after their computers are seized because there are a backlog of cases. Why is this the case?
Well, anytime that you have a lot of evidence seized, and in the digital world, there's going to be a lot of evidence seized. So you may have, in a typical case, thousands of images that have to be sorted through. And law enforcement has to determine if those really are children, if they're children who are below the age of 18, if they're prepubescent children, which is a different rating, where those images came from, whether they were stored, whether they were downloaded, whether they were copied, whether they were transmitted. I mean, there's all these different things that impact not only the charge but the sentence in these particular cases. And that has to be done carefully, because certainly you do not want one of these offenders who has this interest and has this dangerousness for society to go free because you didn't do a good enough job doing your investigation and prosecution. So there is a lot of this kind of casework out there, which means you're going to get backlogs, and then it has to be done carefully. It's just not something where you can smell marijuana smoke and know it's marijuana. You can't necessarily look at an image and know for certain that that is child pornography. And then we have to do a lot of work trying to find the victims. So some of these are known victims, and we have to notify them that they've yet again shown up in some offender's computer system. And so we work hard to do all those things right so that we make sure when we get this person off the street, they stay off the street.
So technology is making it easier for people to create and view child pornography. What about for the investigators? Is technology making it easier for them to investigate?
In some ways. In some ways, it's easier for us to anonymously reach out to them and work with trying to get them to send us images or do other things to help capture them. But the problem is you can hide through many layers of these technologies, and we just can't do some of the things they can do. We are never going to send them child pornography. We are never going to create child pornography to become welcome in this little world that they have. So while we can help identify what computers maybe or what email addresses they have going and then finding the person sitting at that computer or the person behind those websites is much more difficult, and they may be overseas, and that poses a whole new series of problems. They may have hopped through several computers. You have people at an office place who share computers, and so you've got to really track down who's behind those anonymous websites and URL addresses.
We were talking about the case of Garrett Drew Ringer. I think that you mentioned that he faces a minimum of 5 years. How is it decided how long in prison people can face?
Well, there's different types of child pornography charges. So there's possession or receipt, which is really just going to be up to 10 years of imprisonment. You have transmitting or creating child pornography, the production of child pornography, which is a 15 to 30 year type of sentence. And so the sentences available, both the mandatory minimum and the maximum they could serve, change depending on what they did with that child pornography, whether they were involved in creating it, whether they then transported it to other people, whether they received it, or whether they merely looked at it, possessed it, had it for a short period of time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa, Stephanie Rose. We're talking about the rise in child pornography and the efforts of the Department of Justice to combat that. Stephanie Rose, the Supreme Court in 2005 and 2007 made rulings effectively making mandatory guidelines for prison sentencing advisory. That's according to a study conducted by the Wall Street Journal earlier this year. That report also shows that federal judges are looking more skeptically at prosecutors' requests to give 15 to 25-year sentences for some child pornography crimes. And from this time last year to the year before, federal judges gave prison sentences below the guidelines 44% of the time, and that's according to the U.S. Sentencing Commission. Now, you're a career-long prosecutor. What's your reaction to this?
Well, there's a couple of different things going on in that question. One, there are two pieces to any federal sentence. There are the United States Sentencing Guidelines, and there are the statutes. And the statutes is the criminal code. That's what Congress has passed. Those are our laws. The Sentencing Guidelines were what were developed by the Sentencing Commission, which came in and said, when this particular law is broken, what's the sentence that's reasonable to punish that person? The Supreme Court did come down and say that the Sentencing Guidelines are advisory. The judges don't have to follow those if they don't want to, but the criminal code remains. So those 15 to 30-year sentences, that 15-year mandatory minimum, that 5-year mandatory minimum that we just spoke of, those remain. Those weren't changed by the Supreme Court decision. But certainly we have seen judges come in particular in the possession and receipt cases where there's not the transmission of child pornography or the creation of child pornography, coming in and saying, we feel that these sentences are too harsh. And so we're seeing a fair amount of variances, they're called, where the judges don't sentence under the advisory guidelines in those areas. Now, those are different in kind. Those aren't the people who made the child pornography. They're not people who are trading child pornography. They're people who may have done nothing more than log on to a website that has child pornography and look at it on their computer. That is a federal crime. And so judges, I think, feel differently, in some ways understandably, about those crimes than they do about the man who's taken a 5-year-old and raped her online for all his friends to watch. And so I think those are differences that are out there. Now, what is being studied right now and what I think will impact those sentences and judges is whether or not the people who are interested in just looking at it, and they haven't reached the point where they're transmitting it, they haven't reached the point where they're creating it, whether those people are dangerous to children, whether they're people who would go out and create touching offenses. You know, are they going to molest? Are they going to stalk? Are they going to kidnap? Are they going to rape a child? Are they going to become, as they that interest grows, the people who make the child pornography or molest children or hurt children? And that's still being studied, and there's mixed results. There are some studies that say, yes, people who are interested in looking at this will eventually move on to helping victimize children in a different way. And there are studies that say, no, there are people who will just look at it and are interested in it and never do more. And so I think judges will be highly influenced by the results of those studies as they continue, but we just don't know at this point what the result of that will be.
From your experiences as a prosecutor, do you find that there is a link between the two, those viewing child pornography and those who would potentially molest children?
I think our office typically takes on those receipt and possession cases the offenders who have a history of being more proactively out there and being dangerous to children. That doesn't mean that all people who look at child pornography are child molesters. But the ones we see, I think, typically have in their background problems that would indicate they're dangerous to children. And often in their supervised release conditions, they are not allowed to be near children and they're registered as sex offenders because the judge finds that they do pose a danger to children.
And just before this, we were talking about the leniency that some judges would have just for those who view sexually explicit images of children. Do you find that judges here in Iowa, at least in your district, are being lenient as far as those crimes are concerned?
I think we have a number of judges in our district, and I think they have different opinions, like most people who would be polled might. And so one of our judges, I think, generally is more lenient in those cases. One of our judges is very interested in what the parties think and what they feel is an appropriate resolution. And the third judge kind of vacillates depending on the facts. And these are very fact-driven cases. And so, you know, I don't have any one answer that sums up our particular judges.
Mm-hmm. What can parents do to try to prevent maybe their child in engaging in these if they're older, 16 or 17 years old? But what can parents do to try to prevent these horrific crimes?
Well, I think there's a whole series of things that parents want to do. One is as far as sexting goes, talk to your children. That's always the first thing in drug prevention and sexting prevention. Talk to your children about the consequences and then monitor it. Look through their cell phones from time to time. See what's in there and tell your kids you're going to do it. Almost all of the major cell phone companies allow you to get cloning on your phones where every text message your child gets, you get a copy of. Whether you choose to install that or not, certainly you can tell your kids you will if you ever have concerns about them. You want to talk to your teachers and other parents and about sexting as a group, because this is a peer pressure issue. With respect to child pornography, children are often lured into child pornography when they're sort of in the 11, 12, 13, 14 age by people they meet online. I would really highly recommend that no parent let their kids be in chat rooms. There is no good reason for chat rooms, and a huge amount of recruiting into sex crimes happens by predators in chat rooms. I would not have a computer that isn't sitting in the middle of your house somewhere where you can monitor what they're doing. And I would tell my child, if they minimize the screen or they lock the screen or they hide what they're doing when you walk into the room, they're done using the computer. And I would get all the parents of the children that your child associates with to try and abide by those same rules so they can't go to another house where they're not being seen. You know, I would love and encourage and tell my children how proud and happy I am with them, because it's almost always the children who are not getting as much of that as they need at home that get culled out of the group and become easy victims for this kind of thing. So a lot of it is just basic good parenting. It's knowing what your kids are doing. It's being involved in what they're doing. It's watching what's happening. And then when it happens, and sometimes great parents have a child who's victimized for reasons that just happen, work with your child to get the counseling they need. Work with the law enforcement officers to catch the person who did it. And really, that's all the advice we can offer somebody at this time.
What about efforts at school? You were talking about efforts that parents can do, checking their cell phones. But when I hear of a child pornography case, it often seems like it's the teacher or the bus driver that has slipped through the cracks and has been engaging in this. How do those people slip through the cracks? And what, if anything, can be done to stop that?
Well, I think we could probably find a child pedophile in every career in the country. They simply are out there. And so I think we resonate more on that, and we remember it more when it happens to be a bus driver or a teacher or a police officer, because it's so shocking to us that the people who are supposed to protect our children might do that. But the fact of the matter is, there is no profession that's safe. There is no profession that's not worth, if your spider instincts go off, reacting to. Maybe it is that doctor. Maybe it is that priest. Maybe it is that teacher. And so as a parent, I think you look for all the warning signs and you do everything you can to prevent anyone from having unauthorized or unsupervised access to your children. But as far as preventing them from becoming employed, I think Iowa schools are doing a better and growing job of checking against backgrounds, of checking references. And every school should be doing that. They ought to be checking their employees and people who are bus drivers or who are school guards or who are whatever against registries and against references, because those references often are going to be the people who are going to tell you about those things.
And very quickly, are you aware of any education initiatives that are involved with trying to prevent this rise in the spread of images?
Yes, our office has done a whole series of, PSC talks is what we would call them, where we went out to all the middle schools in our district and talked with the schools. We are working on getting together some additional information about sexting. Certainly, the time that we often push those things out to schools is towards the summer, as kids are going to be more unsupervised and more accessible to child pornographers. But we have a whole wealth of information. We're happy to talk to any group that needs that information. We can either get it out by video, or if it's a big enough group, we can come talk to them in person, or certainly we can send educational materials to them.
My guest for this first half hour has been U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa, Stephanie Rose. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, we'll have a discussion about foster care in Iowa. The number of children placed in foster care over the last 4 years is declining, and the Iowa Department of Human Services is increasing its efforts to have a more family-centered approach when either counseling or removing children from a home if that's needed. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back after this break. We're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us over the noon hour. I'm Alex Hoyer, in today for Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, join us for a conversation with NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston. She visits Grinnell College this week to discuss her unique role working with the FBI and the CIA. We'll also talk with Iowa comedian Nathan Timmel. He's just returned from another trip to Iraq to entertain the troops. He'll give us an update from his unique perspective. But for the rest of this hour, we're getting an update on the foster care system in Iowa. Numbers released by the Iowa Department of Human Services in December of last year show about 5,600 Iowa children are out of their original home in family foster homes, a relative's home, a shelter, or some other arrangement. About just as many children are at homes where the families are receiving counseling. But over the last 4 years, the number of children placed in foster care has dropped by more than 20%. Have you been involved with Iowa's foster care system, either as a foster parent or someone who had your kids taken away? Or maybe you were a foster child? Share your experiences with us at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. You can send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk, and we're on Facebook. Find us at Iowa Public Radio. Joining me now to talk about this trend in foster care in Iowa is Roger Munns, the Public Information Officer for the Iowa Department of Human Services, joining us from Iowa Public Radio studios in Des Moines. Thanks for being with us, Roger.
Afternoon, Alex.
Also joining us from Des Moines is Denise Moore, a parent partner coordinator with the Iowa DHS and the program manager for Community Partnership for Protecting Children in Polk County. And welcome back to The Exchange, Denise.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Before we talk a little bit about the numbers, Denise, what are some of the events that led to you becoming a parent partner coordinator with the DHS?
Well, I had my children removed from my care in 2003 due to my long history with substance abuse. I started doing AmeriCorps member with Prevent Child Abuse Iowa and got the job of Community Partnership for Protecting Children Program Manager, and started with one of the four pilot sites for parent partners. Parent partners are parents that have had their children removed and had been successfully reunited, and we come back and help parents that are coming into the system.
And how do you help them?
We guide them. I think the most important thing we do is offer hope to the families. We also guide them through the court process, help them understand what's happening. We do connect them to community resources and really just mentor them and guide them through the system.
Roger Munns, I want to talk about this pre-removal conference in just a second, but that's only been in place for a few years, right?
No, it's actually newer than that, I think, and it's geographically limited to the Polk mm-hmm. County area.
Tell us what that program is.
Well, the idea is, just like Denise said, is to give parents hope, but it's a new program in Polk County. Every case in where there's going to be a removal for a child, because for safety reasons, there is a conference with the parent to explain to them what's going to happen, and to make it so that their parents can quickly understand that what's going to happen and what they can do to start the reunification process. The whole idea is to get rid of some of the angst and some of the fear, and to make the transition as smooth as possible for both parents and the child, and to get them moving on the road to reunification as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. And Denise Moore, you work with these parents. You participate in this pre-removal conference. How can you approach something like that?
Well, the assessment worker, when there's a child going to be removed, contacts or goes out and does an investigation. So at that time, there's the safety issues for the children. Then there's a meeting set up, and we have a family team meeting facilitator come in. We have a nurse that takes care of the immediate medical needs for the children. We have a parent partner who meets the family outside of the room and tells a little bit about where we come from and helps explain the process and kind of prepares the family for the meeting. We have the ongoing worker and the assessment worker all meeting together, and we talk about if there's relative placements. We try to identify relative placements for the family. We try to identify non-custodial parents. We try to work with what community resources, try to get them a jump start on their case plan. So sometimes before they even go to court, then they've already had a mental health or substance abuse evaluation, or they've met with their children. Another goal of the meeting is how we set up a family interaction plan. So we want to get visits with the kids as soon as possible to keep that connection strong and to relieve some of the anxiety around the whole removal process.
How do parents typically react, or is there just not a typical reaction that parents have when you go in there and say that the state is taking your children away from you?
Well, it's traumatizing for the parents, but this is more of a holistic approach. Before, previously, it would be kind of the assessment worker coming in with the cops, and they knock on your door and say, we're going to remove the kids. Here's a chance where we can kind of prepare the parent for their time that they would meet with the kids, so it's less traumatic for the kids, and also establish what the immediate needs are for the family. Mm-hmm. I think they come in at different ranges, but I've heard from people that have been through the system previously that it's like a brand new system to them.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that having had your children taken away from you, do you feel that that perspective helps you with these pre-removal conferences?
Absolutely. Well, for one, I can say to the parents, I've been through this. I've had my kids removed. I had five kids, and they were all removed. And today I have all my kids back. We're successful. My kids are all doing good, and you can do it too. Mm-hmm. So it really inspires hope with the families.
Roger Munns, how do you gauge the success of this new program, this pre-removal conference?
Well, I think part of it's anecdotal. We're getting reports back now that the agency is on your side, even though this traumatic action is going to take place. Before, there was sort of the street understanding that the DHS was somehow out there to take your child, which, of course, is not true. And another area of success is our interaction with judges. Remember, this is a court-driven process, and our juvenile judges have told us that the preparation of both the agency and the parents when the parents come before them is just remarkably improved because of all the communication that we're doing ahead of time. So, we're pleased with the result. Our federal evaluators have just come to evaluate the state, and they told us that this was a very promising practice.
Mm-hmm. We want to reach out to our exchange listeners. Have you been involved with Iowa's foster care system, either as a foster parent, someone who had your kids taken away, or as a foster child? You can give us a call and share your stories with us at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. You can send us an email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Earlier, I said that over the past 4 years, the number of children placed in foster care has dropped by more than 20%. Roger Munns, why is this the case?
Well, you're right. First of all, Alex, the numbers have gone down. In the last year for which we've got numbers, there was about 2,297 kids in actual foster placement. That doesn't include the number that were in placement with relatives. And you ask why? Well, I think it's probably because we're doing a better job of assessing the family itself for safety. Remember, the overarching goal is safety for kids. And the goal is to make sure that, the child is safe whether you have to remove or not. I think that social workers are telling me that they're doing a better job of evaluating the family for safety issues. For instance, maybe years ago, the social worker might think, well, we can't leave the child here because the house is really dirty. It's not like my house. Or the social worker might have thought, this house is chaotic and there doesn't seem to be an order here. We can't leave the child in. We're now more culturally sensitive, and we're not approaching the child from the standpoint of the social worker's home, but from the idea of whether or not it's safe to leave the child. And obviously, they've come to the conclusion that it's safe to leave kids in the home more times than before.
And how is that determination really made? What's the line that has to be crossed when it's decided whether a child will be removed?
Well, it's a judgment call. Obviously, we have professional social workers out there. making this call all the time. In fact, last year there were more than 25,000 investigations across the state. And an investigation is triggered when our intake unit gets a call and figures there's enough reason to go out and check to see if there was abuse there. Interestingly enough, of those 25,000 investigations, only about 2,000 or so resulted in removals. And of those 25,000 investigations, about a third resulted in findings of abuse, and the rest of them were findings of no abuse. Mm.
Denise Moore, looking back on what happened, do you think having your children removed was a good thing?
I believe that that's what needed to happen for me to change my life around. I was at the end of my rope when it all happened, and I had nowhere else to turn. And DHS came in and changed my life around. I mean, today I have a life that I never could have dreamed possible if it wasn't for that, for DHS coming in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are the most common types of child abuse which can lead to removal? I don't know if that's better for Roger or
sure.
you, Denise.
Well, I can take a stab at it. In Iowa, we have numerous types of abuse, and sometimes that word gets misunderstood. My dearest neighbor always tells me that when there is a case of child abuse, why on earth does the DHS even leave the child at home ever? And I try to explain to her that 80% of abuses in this state is really neglect. We call it denial of critical care. Mm-hmm. And the child was placed in harm's way, but no actual harm came to that child. These are cases like where the child is – or where the parent is disabled because of drugs or alcohol or some other reason, or a case where the parent doesn't pay appropriate attention and the child is sitting in a hot car or out playing in the street or something. These are serious issues, but it's no actual physical harm came to the child. That's 80%. Another 10% or so is physical abuse, and the rest is divided into lots of other categories.
Mm-hmm. What is the process for alleging abuse? If somebody thinks that there is abuse going on in a household, how should they approach that?
Well, the most common way is to give us a call. And I have the number here written down. I'll share it to you as soon as I come across it. But
sure.
It's the idea is to call the hotline number, and here it is, 800-362-2178. And that call will go to a centralized intake unit, which will evaluate the call to determine if there's enough evidence to actually send out an investigator.
Can that be reported anonymously?
Yes, it can. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to report as much as you have seen yourself, not something that's just secondhand information or something that you're trying to get somebody else in trouble. Send us information or call us with information that you know to be true, and we'll send an assessor out. And as I explained, we send assessors out about 25,000 times a year.
Mm. Who are the people who typically report the abuse, or does it pretty much vary?
Boy, it's all over the board, Denise. You may know more than I do about that, but there are mandatory reporters, and those are people like healthcare professionals and teachers and others. And then there are just anybody can report it. I don't remember the breakdown. Do you, Denise?
I think a major portion of the calls come from schools.
Mm. How did the DHS come to the attention with you, Denise?
I got arrested for conspiracy to deliver meth, and so I knew DHS was coming. I got bailed out of jail, and then 2 days later, an assessment worker came to my door. So. Mm-hmm.
And then I read online that you were more scared of the DHS than you were of being arrested.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. because I was faced in prison, but if I was going to, back then it was more if DHS comes into your life, you're going to lose your kids. And I figured if I did what I was supposed to do for DHS, that the rest would fall into place, and that's kind of how it happened.
So, what did the DHS do that really helped you? That was able to change your life around?
Well, first thing I did was get into substance abuse treatment, but then I think they helped me to be accountable and to face what I'd been doing to my kids and the life that I'd been living. When I started taking responsibility for what I'd done, my life started changing, and I started taking the next steps to get my life back together.
Mm-hmm. Roger Munns, I want to turn to you. As far as the number of child welfare and foster care cases are concerned, are there adequate resources to handle the caseload?
Well, that's kind of a complicated question. There are two sets of social workers who are primarily involved with this work. The first group is the assessors, and those are the people who go out and make a determination, is there really abuse going on here? And I've forgotten how many we have, something like 220 or so of them. And each of them gets an average of 11 or 12 new cases a month. Mm-hmm. And for each case, you need to go out and do a thorough assessment. You interview everybody involved. National standards call for these types of workers to have about the same number of cases that we have in Iowa. There's perhaps greater pressure on a second group. Those are the case managers. These are the people who oversee the management of the case once there has been a determination of abuse, figuring out what services that family needs and how to deliver those services. Those people have greater and greater caseloads, and there is a lot of pressure on those people. One of the things that they are required to do is to try to visit every child every month, and that's in addition to all of the visits that those children receive in our contracted services.
So
you say, is there enough? Mm-hmm. Well, I think our administrators would always say we could certainly use some more people.
Mm-hmm. So I would assume that there is some type of priority ranking on what cases are investigated and acted upon by the department.
Well, for sure. When we get a call for a child abuse or neglect, if it's an infant, for instance, we have to be there within an hour. We have people on call around the clock, holidays, et cetera. And our response time has to be within one day, I believe, Denise, if it's any other type of accepted intake.
At what point is it decided whether parents will actually lose their parental rights?
Well, this is an assessment, an evaluation by our folks, and we make a recommendation to the court on whether at the point where we believe it's not safe to reunify the child. Mm-hmm. We are evaluated on how well we do this work, and the federal government our federal partners have decided that we do a pretty good job of it. But you take into consideration several common sense factors. Is it safe to return the child? Have the caretakers acknowledged what their weaknesses were, and have they made amends? Have they gotten their lives back together? And in cases where they haven't or they're not willing to do it in a reasonable time, then the proceeding starts for termination of the parental rights and adoptions.
Mm. Denise Moore, you mentioned that you're involved with this pre-removal conference. Have you gone through what happens once children are ready to be reunited with their families? Do you have involvement at that point?
When families are reunified?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what is that experience like? I imagine that there's probably a lot of joy.
There is a lot of joy. It's a happy time. Sometimes, there's still ongoing treatment that needs to be happening for the families because they've been through a traumatizing event. I mean, mm-hmm. and well before they came into DHS, there still has to be continued work. But it's the kids are, you know, it's just it's a wonderful thing to see the families being reunified and being back together. Mm-hmm. We also celebrate it every year too. Through our model court project in Polk County, we do a reunification picnic and our CBBC, our Community Partnership for Protecting Children, and celebrate all the families that have been reunified throughout the year.
Mm-hmm. I've been to those picnics, Alex, and it really is a joyful time. Those are the parents who have gone through the struggles, have done what's needed to reunify, and they're celebrating with us their success. It's a joyful time.
What kind of continued involvement does the DHS have with counseling and other things that they would do?
You mean after reunification?
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, hopefully the case is closed. We want to be out of their lives, and they can be on their own.
Mm-hmm. There has been some critique of Iowa's foster care system. Richard Wexler of the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform a couple of weeks ago criticized Iowa and some other heartland states for continuing to take children into foster care at high rates. What's your reaction to this?
Well, I'm not his statistics, I think, are – well, you have to take them with a grain of salt. They're as good as they go, but – for instance, the numbers that he uses don't include all the number of kids who are in the juvenile justice system. In Iowa's case, there's more than 500. So his rankings don't include that. He also doesn't take into consideration all of the times that all the effort that we have to find relative placements. It's not just when we decide that there needs to be a removal, we look very hard for a family member to step forward and to step up while the regular caretakers are getting their acts together. Mm-hmm. Mr. Wexler's doesn't take that into consideration in his rankings. I don't know if you took all those other figures or all those factors into consideration how we would stack up. But I do know that the rate of removals to foster care are coming down in Iowa. And we fully subscribe to the goal by the Casey Foundation to reduce the number of kids in foster care by half. Mm-hmm. That goal was set up about, I think, 2 years ago, and we're in line with that.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank my guests for this last half of our show. Roger Munns, the Public Information Officer for the Iowa DHS. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks, Alex.
And Denise Moore, Parent Partner Coordinator with the Iowa DHS and involved with the Polk County in protecting children. Thank you for being on our program.
Thank you very much.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon and Mitch Schmidt. Technical support comes from Dennis Reese in Des Moines, John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. I'm Alex Hoyer. Thanks for joining us.